All right. Good morning. My wife is an avid listener to the radio, particularly Radio 4. Whenever she's doing anything around the house, she will almost always have the radio somewhere near her. She says, and there's a lot of sense in this, she much prefers listening to the radio than watching a television set. Because with a radio, you just need to listen and you can get on with a dozen other things at the same time. It's logical. There is just one flaw in her reasoning. When you're doing the dozen other things, you don't always listen quite as closely as you might. Some time ago, she was somewhat irritated, said to me, and the radio's still on at this time, I can't for the life of me understand why this program is all about blue tack. She said they've got three academics discussing the merits of blue tack. They are saying that blue tack changed the course of history. Now, she's getting very annoyed at this time, saying, it's a useful substance for sticking things on a wall, but that's a bit over the top. So together we stopped and listened a little more closely to the radio program. It was not about blue tack. It was about the philosopher and essayist, the great Greek philosopher Plutarch. It really does make all the difference when you pay proper attention. Now, why do I tell you that story? I tell you it because everybody knows or thinks they know the story of Jonah and the whale. The man and the sea mammal go together like fish and chips. But again, it's a case of not paying enough attention. For a start, there's no mention of a whale in the biblical record. It simply says a great fish. And in the whole book of Jonah, there are just three brief references to this great fish in the entire tale. It's certainly part of the story, but it's no longer, like we sometimes make it, the whole story. Now, there are two or three problems when you don't pay attention like that. First of all, and I fully understand why you're using it for your kids' club in summertime, it's a great story for children. But I think we've tucked it away as a children's story. And actually, it is my conviction that if we read Jonah seriously, it might significantly change how we do church and how we look at the world around us. I think it is one of the most important books in the Old Testament. The other problem is that we glibly think we know, and with no real understanding of what Jonah is all about. There's a third problem, of course, because this whole idea of a man being swallowed by a fish has troubled people over the years. And some folk have said it's simply an unbelievable story. And others have disagreed. Even two of the greatest figures in church history, Origen, who lived in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, knowing that the Bible incorporates different kinds of literature, such as poetry and parable, believed that the whole story was allegorical and not actually historically true. Augustine of Hippo, on the other hand, said, no, it's a really true story. So just to clear things up and let you know where I stand, I'll simply say that every day we learn so much about strange events that are difficult to explain that I don't find it all that hard to believe that a great sea creature could swallow a man and he might survive. And even more to the point, since my faith commits me to believe in the really big miracle of a God who raised Jesus from the dead, I can cope with the fact that he could send the right fish at the right time to save Jonah from drowning. Whatever position you take, you do well to heed the advice of a preacher I once heard who said, the fish didn't let Jonah stick in his throat, so don't let the fish stick in yours. It's a story, or at least a bit that we are reading today, that begins with this great fish. But the book of Jonah is a great book. And it is not primarily about a great fish. It is primarily a story about a great God. See, here's the problem with Jonah. Jonah's God was too small. He was a God who was confined to the borders of Israel. In Jonah's mind, God shouldn't have anything to do with those pagan people over in Nineveh. He was a God who cared only for his chosen people. And he was a God who could be escaped simply by running away to sea. There are lots of people who are believers, but have a big problem because their God is too small. I don't know if you've ever read Henry Fielding's novel, Tom Jones. And in it, we encounter the comic figure of Parson Thwackum, who gives expression to this narrow-minded, too small picture of God in his unforgettable testimony to his faith. This is what Parson Thwackum says. When I mention religion, I mean the Christian religion. And not only the Christian religion, but the Protestant religion. And not only the Protestant religion, but the Church of England. That's what I mean. A picture of God that is too small. The big fish that swallowed Jonah didn't simply happen to be passing by some lucky chance. It was the Hebrew word in verse 17, now the Lord provided a huge fish, a great fish, to swallow Jonah. That word could easily be equally well translated as designated or appointed. God, in the same way that earlier in the story, he sent the wind that raised the storm at sea, God sends a big fish to swallow Jonah. The point that we and Jonah are meant to grasp is that God is not just the God of one people or one nation. He is not confined to one region or one sphere of human activity. He is indeed the great God of creation and human history, as you sang in that last song, expressed in simple language that kids could understand. God is the God of all history and all creation. There's something more that the first people who heard the story of Jonah would have realized that we probably don't. The arrival of a big fish in the story would have had a significance that isn't obvious to us. See, the people of Israel were surrounded by the Canaanite people, and they had their own mythology of the world and how it was created. And in the mythology of the Canaanite people, there was a great sea monster called Leviathan. It was a creature of such brutal strength and force that it featured in tales of primeval conflict and would even wrestle with the gods and bring chaos. Leviathan stood for the fact that the gods were not powerful against these primeval forces. But in telling that Jonah was swallowed by a big fish appointed by God, the writer of Jonah is doing more than just telling us an incident in the story. What he is doing is inviting his readers to see that Yahweh, the God of Israel, unlike the gods of the surrounding nations, is truly the ruler of creation and the Lord of all created things, however powerful or dangerous. The universe is not just some cosmic accident. It's not even just the result of primeval forces. The universe exists because it is the work of our Creator God, who sustains it by his word of power. And history, as you sung to us, is not just a series of random events. God is active within it. And Everything that happens, and you need to say this carefully at the moment, everything that happens will ultimately serve his purpose. Now, that is not to say that God wills everything. I'm not sure that it even means, in a sense, that God foreknew everything. Because I think a God of love delegates responsibility to us. Our God, I do not believe, foreordained that terrible thing that happened in Manchester last week. I do not believe in a God like that. But I do believe in a loving God who will ultimately use whatever happens to his redemptive purposes. And just before we leave the subject of a great God and move into this great hymn of praise, there's an even deeper wonder in this story of Jonah and in the greatness of God. The Creator God reigns over all. He can summon the elements. He brought up this great storm. He summons this creature from the deep at his command. And yet, at the same time, he allows human beings freedom. There's a little touch of Jewish humor and irony in this story. The great sea monster obeys God's command and turns up at the right time. The winds blow and the sea rages at God's command. But Jonah, whose name actually means the dove of faithfulness, Jonah, the dove of faithfulness, one of God's chosen people, resists God and runs. The God of the universe gives us freedom. But the God of the universe will follow us to the ends of the earth. He will find us wherever we hide. He will face us with the truth of his limitless love. He may even harness the forces of nature to arrest our attention. But he will never force us to do his will. But he will follow us and draw us to himself. Friends, that is a great God. This is not just a kid's story. It is a great story for kids. This is adult literature. So let me come to the great hymn of praise. Let me read it for you. Picking up in chapter 2. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. He said, "In my distress I called to the Lord and he answered me. From the depth of the grave I called for help, and you listened to my cry. You huddled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas, and the current swirled about me, and your waves and breakers swept over me. I said, 'I've been banished from your sight, yet I will look again towards your holy temple.' The engulfing waters threatened me, the deep surrounded me, seaweed wrapped around my head. To the roots of the mountains I sank down, the earth beneath me barred me in forever. But you brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. And when my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple." Don't know about you, but I've sung hymns of praise and said prayers in some unusual places. I remember standing with Margaret and a delightful Indian lady called Prema Rajan at the very southern tip of India, where three seas meet, and together we sang, "Oh Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder consider all the worlds I hands have made." And just a couple of weeks ago, last week, we were up in Scotland, visited Iona, and sailed to Staffa, and entered that cave. I didn't enter it this time. The truth is, this time I got frightened. But previously when we visited, we got into the cave where, of course, Mendelssohn was inspired to write his Hebridean overture. And we've sung in that cave. But those are the kind of settings where the wonder of nature lifts your spirits and the glory of creation makes it difficult not to burst into song. But singing a lengthy psalm all on your own, deep in the belly of a fish, is a different matter. I suspect maybe it was partly from sheer relief. The belly the smelly belly of a fish may not be five-star accommodation, but it's a whole lot better than death by drowning. Most of Jonah's prayer and his song borrows phrases and concepts and words found in the Psalms, but the words for Jonah took on a whole new and deeply personal significance. His prayer, as he had been plunged into the sea, had been answered, albeit in an unexpected manner. In my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. A gracious God had come to his rescue, even though the runaway prophet remembered his God only when his life was ebbing away. It's a truth you encounter again and again in the story of Jonah. God is exceedingly patient with his reluctant servants. There is hope even for the most unwilling disciples and for the most undeserving churches. Mind you, you cannot help but notice that it is not until Jonah reaches the point of death that he begins to come to his senses. When he says at the beginning of his song that he called for help from the depth of the grave, the literal translation of the Hebrew is from the belly of Sheol. And Sheol in Hebrew thinking was the place of the dead. In Jewish thinking at that time, there was no real afterlife. Sheol was a desperate place, a shadowy place of non-existence from which there was no escape and no hope of ever living in the light of God's love again. Forgive me, I don't mean to use profane language, but for Jonah, it's as if he'd been to hell and back. We live in a week which for some people in our city and further afield, they've been to the very depth of things. That first photograph they put on of that sweet-looking little 8-year-old girl who was killed in the terrorist attack breaks your heart. But you think, oh, what must our parents be feeling? Some folk this week have been to hell and back. You don't even need to go to there. There are folk this week who will have been wrestling with depression, for whom it will have felt as if they'd been to hell and back. There are folk this week who will have been bereaved. There are folk this week who will have been disappointed and hurt. It's a tough place to be. But that's where Jonah discovered God and began his journey back to life again. It's really interesting if you read Jonah's hymn, his prayer, carefully. It's all a downward movement. Listen, from deep in the realm of the dead I called and you listened. You hurled me into the depth of the sea and your waves and breakers swept over me. The engulfing waters threatened me. The deep surrounded me. Seaward was wrapped round my head. To the roots of the mountains I sank down. But you, and then it changes, but you, O Lord, brought my life up from the pit. My brothers and sisters who have wrestled with alcoholism sometimes know this truth better than the rest of us. It is only when you get to rock bottom that you're ready to rise again. It is when you get to rock bottom, when you're in the belly of a stinking fish, when there is no hope, when all the pretense is stripped away. That's often when we encounter God. It's often when individuals encounter God. It's often when churches encounter God. We are moving into an era, I believe, when all of the privileges of Christendom may well be stripped away, when we will have no power as a church in earthly terms, but that may be the place and the time in which we discover God. And we discover that we are being brought up from the deep to serve him and to take the message of the gospel to a world that needs it as much as Nineveh did in that day. A great story. Yes, a little bit about a great fish, but mainly about a great God. A great God who reaches people everywhere. And a great hymn of praise in which Jonah realizes this, that as he has been hurled down, it is in the belly of a fish that he meets God. And it ends with a great escape, this bit of the story. Let me remind you of verses 8 to 10. Those who cling to worthless idols turn away from God's love for them. But I, with shouts of joy, with shouts of grateful praise, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed I will make good. I will say, salvation comes from the Lord. And the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. Clearly, we've reached a turning point in Jonah's experience. It has taken a near-death experience to bring the prophet Jonah to the same place as the pagan sailors were. If we'd read the earlier bit in the story, immediately after his unceremonious departure over the side of the ship, they immediately recognized when the storm ended that God was God and was in control. Can I say this to you? It is a fact of experience that often it takes more to move the resistant people of God than those who are outside the structures of church and organized religion. Have you watched what's happened this week in the face of this horrendous, selfish, twisted, destructive act? People come together and recognize that there is something far greater than evil and death and destruction. Any church leader who sought to encourage a change in any congregation will witness to the fact that when prejudice and stubbornness are allied with a narrow view of God's grace and purpose, things are mighty difficult to shift. There are no people in the world more difficult than God's awkward squad. You probably don't have any of them here at Elmwood. I've encountered them in my life. Bless me if you can. I'm not changing. That's my last word on the situation. You know what the heart of Jonah's about turn is? When we hear that declaration of profound truth, salvation comes from the Lord. His plight at that moment is still desperate. The belly of a fish is no place for a permanent residence, but at least he is acknowledging that his hope of deliverance comes not from his nationality or his race or being one of the chosen people, but from the God who made heaven and earth and sea and land. And the question that remains now, as the fish vomits Jonah onto dry land, is, will Jonah now do what God has commanded him to do? And if you read the story of Jonah, you'll see that he kind of does it. He goes to Nineveh. He goes to Nineveh and he proclaims the gospel of God's forgiveness. And then he's ticked off because God actually forgives these people. He's not ready for that kind of crazy stuff, that God will actually forgive the Ninevites. Somebody put on Facebook last week, quite daringly I thought, the Moore's murderer. Oh, the name's gone. Somebody put, oh, thank you very much. That's a senior moment. A good job you're here. Somebody put on Facebook, Jesus died even for Ian Brady. Jesus died even for that sad, sick, misguided individual who walked into Manchester Arena with a bomb on his body. That's how extravagant and ridiculous the gospel is. Jesus died for Christians and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and people of no faith. Jesus died for people who've done terrible things. And Jonah wasn't ready for that. It's one thing to raise our hands in worship and make bold and emotional declarations of faith in God's grace when we're deeply moved and we're in the presence of God's people. It's quite another thing to stand by them when we face the hostility or apathy of those with whom we feel we've little in common. Well, that's where the real test of our faith lies. God is concerned about me and my family and my church and my health and my mortgage. But he is at least as concerned for the asylum seekers, the teenagers with asthmas, the drug addicts, the terrorists, the murderers, the sick, sad people who do what they do. See, here's the irony for Jonah. When the fish pukes him up on dry land, he's about to discover that his deliverance from the deep means that there is, in fact, no escape from the task to which God has called him. The story of Jonah is powerful stuff. One of my ambitions before I die to preach a whole series on Jonah. But there he is, on dry land. Now get to Nineveh. Manchester is waiting for us. The world is waiting for us. We are the people who are commissioned to go with the good news of the gospel. In our streets, in our neighborhoods, as we do our shopping, as we're at our places of employment. That's our Nineveh. And the easier thing is for all of us to escape into church, to be safe. But actually, the only ultimately safe place is to be in the place to which God sends you, is to be with the people to whom we are called. The only thing that justifies our existence is that we are salt and light in a corrupt and dark world.